Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,600 podcast episodes, visit our archives on our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Rosemary Vaswani, author of When I Press Stop, A Memoir of Loss. Rosemary's debut poetry memoir, When I Press Stop, chronicles the heartbreaking loss of her husband to Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease while raising their teenage daughter. Told through lyrical poetry that unfolds like a novel, the collection offers a deeply personal yet ultimately hopeful exploration of grief, healing, and choosing life after profound loss. Born and raised in New York and Puerto Rico, before making Los Angeles home, Rosemary is an actress, author, and storyteller whose work explores love, loss, resilience, and reinvention. Currently recurring on Paramount Plus's hit series, Landman, under the stage name Rosemary Dominguez, she portrays Isabel, a woman whose husband, son, and grandson are tragically killed in the series' opening episode. Rosemary has been writing and performing stories since her teenage years, from stage competitions to LA's White Pub, where she shared her new work at Improv Olympic in Hollywood, as well as True Story at the Ensemble Studio Theater in Atwater Village. For more information, you can visit her website, which is rosemaryvaswani.com, and that's Rosemary, V-A-S-W-A-N-I, V-A-S-W-A-N-I. With that, I'd like to welcome Rosemary to the show. Good day, Rosemary.
Hello. I'm very excited to be here with you.
Thank you. I am as well. I've recently had a number of episodes revolving around grief. And it just seems that, you know, I've had been surrounded by a good deal of loss as well. Mm-hmm. So it seems like I'm kind of drawn to, you know, stories of healing. So I'm really happy to be able to get your story.
Thank you.
So let's start with, as I mentioned in the introduction, you lost your husband to a disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Now that was in, I believe, June 2022, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about Eric, first of all.
He was 56 when he got sick, and Eric was from Oregon, very loving guy. You know, he's the kind of guy that if we were walking down the street and somebody was in need, he was the one that would stop and talk to them and try to help them. And he just had such a big warm spirit, was loved by a lot of people. He played music, he wrote music, he wrote plays, directed me in one play. So we had a very creative relationship, but because I'm an actress and he was a writer and also a songwriter, so he wrote music and just was one of these people that had a zest for life, very enthusiastic. And our daughter, I think, gets some of that zest from him, a lot of curiosity about things. And we came from two total different worlds. I mean, he came from Oregon, I was from New York, and I'm half Dominican, half East Indian, and somehow our worlds came together, and we were a team, you know. We were like soulmates that I just had no idea that this person was out there, and we met when I was like 27 years old, and we met in New York and then moved out to Los Angeles in 2002 and made LA our home here. I want to say the disease basically in 2022, January of 22, he had started to feel just very random symptoms of his arm jerking in the middle of the night, or he'd go for a walk and have just some strange rash on his face. And this would be on a cloudy day, and we'd wonder why is he breaking out. His anxiety was at a different level. And we thought, okay, you know, maybe he's going through some, I don't know, a bout of anxiety, because he had had panic attacks in the past. So we thought, okay, maybe this is, you know, he had started a new job, but everything was going great at that job. And, you know, there was a part of him that thought, wow, this job is going so great. I'm worried that something's going to happen and it's going to go away. And I said, first of all, you need to relax. That's not, you know, it's not necessary. And I said, why don't you talk to your old therapist? And he did at one point, and he thought it was, you know, his habit of waiting for the other shoe to drop. And and so I want to say around, and he went to see his doctor in March, and she put him on depression medication because she thought it was anxiety, but she also sent him to a bunch of doctors. So he saw a cardiologist, a neurologist, an allergist, everything you can imagine. And the last test that he had not had done was the MRI of the brain. But I would say beginning of May is when I started to notice that things were starting to spiral a little bit. Like, he just started printing out calendar pages and writing by hand. And I thought, that's really weird. Why is he not using his phone? And he's always been somebody that's like, put it in the calendar on the phone. And so that was kind of a red flag. And the weekend of Mother's Day, I knew for sure that something was seriously wrong, because he had made breakfast and he was presenting it with our daughter, and he just had this look where he was there, but like it was as though he wasn't there. Like, he was just looking past me, and it just gave me this feeling like, uh-oh, this is, I don't know what he has, but it's bad. And so the next day we ended up in the emergency room, and they told us the following morning that they thought he had CJD. And all they told me was, at that time, they said, which causes Alzheimer's and Parkinson's-like symptoms. I didn't look it up. I was like in the middle of I was at the tail end of finishing this Christmas movie. And I had to go back that evening to finish shooting the last scene. So his brother and sister came. And first of all, when I was told of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, I thought, this is not real. This has to be a mistake. I mean, this man is 56, a young 56-year-old. And I went, I did my things, I came back, and I noticed he was eating worse. Like, he didn't know how to use his phone, and told me that there was something in the bathroom, and or that the ice that they had put in the bathroom was all melted. And I went in there into the hospital bathroom, and there was a melted one, and then there was another tub filled with ice that he could not see. And I thought, oh boy, it's getting worse. And so before we left the hospital, they had done a second MRI, and they said, for sure, we think this is what he has, and it's fatal. And that was the first time, because I had not, like I said, I had not looked it up, and it was basically the last thing either one of us expected. And the first thing that Eric said was, I'm worried about my wife and my daughter. And I would say 2 weeks later, we found out for sure from the expert, one of the experts in the field at UCSF, that that is what he had. We drove to San Francisco, and that was not an easy drive by any means. My brother-in-law and sister-in-law were with us, and we were told for sure that he had that. And we came back, and the next day I told our daughter, who was 15 at the time, that he was dying. And it was probably one of the most difficult conversations I've ever had to have. But she had been witness to all of the strange behavior from the time we got home from the hospital, which included hallucinations and, you know, he couldn't talk anymore. Like it was just very short sentences, and sometimes they were nonsensical. And so she knew that there was something, but we both thought that whatever it was, it could be cured and that he'd be okay. So, anyway, so I put him on hospice, and he died 10 days later. So it was all within a month, and it was so fast that it was very hard to process. And so I felt like that first year, I was, especially those first few weeks, I was walking around in this daze, just like, what just happened? Like, did this happen? Did this happen? You yourself have separated from your body, and you're watching what's happening, and you're thinking, this isn't real. Is someone going to wake me up and tell me, you know, no, it was just a dream? But as time went on, you realize, no, it's not a dream. This happened. And now how do we move forward?
So. Yeah, and that is such a fast-paced, disease. I mean, that is really something. And with seeing it happen so quickly, it also had to have, I would think, even a much more profound impact on you and your daughter, you know, seeing it and just happening so quick. Because many times like that, like with when you mentioned Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, you know, it's over a period of time. I mean, a longer period of time.
Yeah.
So, you know, but with that compact time frame, it had to have been exceptionally challenging.
Oh, yes. I mean, there was something like, you know, I didn't understand the disease. I started to understand it as I was going through it, but one of the things that I thought was very strange is if I would get up in the morning he was still in bed, and I'd go to the bathroom or take a shower or whatever, and if I came back in the room and he had woken up while I was away, he would be completely terrified and would be holding the sheets over his head in a fist. Just shaking, and it would take me, I want to say, like 10 minutes to calm him down and to say, it's okay, you're safe, you're okay. And he would slowly bring his hands down, but it felt like I was dealing with a child. So I went from, you know, my husband to now, like, it felt like I was dealing with a son. And it was so, it was a lot. Take in.
Yeah, very heartbreaking, that's for sure. Now I understand after he passed, you took to writing.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, continued, you know, you obviously had been before, but writing played an important part in your healing process. So can you tell us kind of how that came about and the style that you ended up writing in?
Yeah, so I had a writing mentor that told me, she said, you need to write as much as possible because as you move through your grief, you're going to start forgetting things. And so I would write essays or journal entries, but what would happen is it would take a lot out of me, and I would start crying and then I just somehow I had this thing where I had to pick up my tax returns, and I didn't know that there would be a section in the forms that would say signing for the deceased spouse. And that I saw it, and I I had to hold in whatever I was feeling. And the moment I left that office, I cried for hours. It was the most brutal realization that, okay, this is real. I couldn't stop crying. And at one point that day, and I'm talking hours, like just constant crying, I sat down and I had a paper and a pen, and I just started writing what happened, like when I walked into the office. And it was very staccato, and it was just like Chipper greets me at the front door because she was very chipper, and I'm in this other place, and I'm interrupting her lunch of fried vegetable sticks, and then I see it, the words. And so I wrote down the entire thing, what happened, in this poem, and I couldn't believe, I mean, it came out like in this very quick stream. It was almost like when you have to get something out and it comes out fast. And that's how that poem came out. And I just looked at it and I read it and I thought, oh my God, this is really, it's raw. But I shared it with my brother-in-law and my sister-in-law, and they were like, whoa, this is very hard to read, but it's good. And then I sent it to my grief counselor, and she agreed. And when I was trying to figure out how to write the book because of my feelings, every time I would write in essay format, she said, why don't you write it as poetry? You've done that before. And I had written another essay called Sunflower Oil about him, poem about him filling a glass with sunflower oil, thinking it was juice, and leaving it on the counter. And so I had written about that, and she said, why don't you write it that way? And so I decided that I would sit down every night and think about an event that happened within that month. And I would, wherever I was mentally, right, whatever I could handle. And I didn't go in order. So it would either be, you know, the day that he stopped walking, I was trying to get him to the bathroom, and I called it make wifey happy, because he would like stop, and you know, and or actually it's called shimmy shimmy, and I would say okay come on honey, shimmy shimmy shimmy, and I would do like this little this little dance with him to get him to kind of shuffle his feet to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. and I'd say, do you want to make wifey happy? And he would like roll, you know, like nod yes, like a little boy. And mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. come on. So I wrote a poem about that. So there were all these memories that were there that I hadn't talked about. And so all of a sudden I had 40 poems. And then I ended up adding more after he had passed away. And then I also added poems from when we first met and we had our daughter. And so it became a full journey, and it kind of reads like this novel, because you start at the love story and this couple who meet and have a child, and then they move to California, and then you hear about the first signs of the disease, and then its arrival, and then after his death, and how it was living in this apartment after he was gone, and yet feeling him around us as well.
Well, you know, that's wonderful. Now, often recommended, you know, that people write, you know, and not necessarily get it to the point of, you know, publication, but mm-hmm. but the process of itself is very healing.
Yes. I agree. And I've written my whole life, but this was the first time where I felt strongly that I wanted to get it published, because I wanted to raise awareness about the disease. And that was really important for me. And I had started recording myself, reading some of the poems and posting them on Instagram. And then I reached out to the CJD Foundation, and I told them what I was doing, and I said, you can direct people to my site if they, I'm sharing about my experience, and then they asked me if they could post some of the poems on their website. And so they ended up doing that, putting 4 poems, and then afterwards they asked me if I could be on a panel for their conference in Washington, D.C., and it was talking about your using arts in the media to talk about your CJD journey. So I had to say yes. And I was, to be honest, I was afraid of going to the conference. I thought it was going to be, too overwhelming being in a room with people who had lost family members to CJD, but it was actually the opposite. It felt like this incredible community where I was able to have conversations, and I would go up to somebody and just say, who did you lose, or how long has it been? And it was just incredible to feel safe enough to be in that environment and to have those talks.
Yeah. Well, you're among people who have had the same type of experience that you have. So there's a whole lot of explaining that doesn't need to go on. And the fact that it's a rare disease. I had to look it up when I first started researching, for today's show. And so it's really, I think important, it's often said it's good to have a certain support group, family, maybe even your congregation or something like that. But also having people who have had that shared experience, you really can't top that.
No, it's important. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, a distinction that you make regarding the healing process is that moving forward can be more healing than trying to move on. Because, for those of us who have lost someone close to us, one of the first things is like, how are you doing? How are you getting, are you moving on? And it's like, no. So can you talk a little bit about that? Your perspective on that?
Yeah. So it's I feel like when you experience loss, other people say, have you moved on or whatever. It's I feel like it's impossible to move on, but you can move forward. So it's like I like to think of it as you look at the rear view mirror, and your person that you lost is in the back. And you can see them, but you're still moving forward. You're driving, and you're going. I hope I'm explaining this correctly.
I understand.
So that person will always be with you. With Eric, I felt very much that I didn't want to run away from the anniversaries, the birthdays. Any of it. So, even my wedding anniversary, he died in June, and September would have been our 24th wedding anniversary. And so I remember thinking, I don't want to pretend like this is not happening. So I had, his brother and sister over, and then our best couple friends came over. And I did a toast, and I said, I want to celebrate the marriage, because it was an incredible marriage. And yes, we had a typical marriage, you're ups and you're downs, but we raised this incredible human being, and I want to celebrate that, the marriage. And so I have that. And there was one year where I didn't want to have a big thing, and I didn't remind my daughter that it was my anniversary. And I just felt like at that time, it felt like a more private thing. We were having dinner, and I said, by the way, it's my wedding anniversary. And she got mad. She said, why didn't you say anything? I would have done something. I said, honey, I didn't want to do anything. It was something for me. Like I was feeling it. I honored it my way. And that was good enough. That's what I needed. So, but it wasn't, I acknowledged it. Even when I was, I didn't tell her, I acknowledged it for myself. So I feel like that's a way of, you always have that with you. The person is part of your life. I'm never going to not think about my husband or
right.
the impact he's had on our lives. And
okay. And
so I like to think that he's still influencing, you know, the things that my daughter does or the things that I do or decisions that I make or, you know, so I hope that answers the question of moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, it does. And the one thing about, you know, you mentioned the celebrating of, you know, the anniversary is that, you know, the idea of, you know, the first holiday sense or the first birthday sense or first anniversary sense, you know, that can be challenging. And in many times, I think, you know, we put it forward to those people who were also affected, you know, by the loss, you know, as a way of celebrating that. But you're right, you know, you do have that ability to celebrate within yourself that particular spirit.
Yes. Or even honor that person. And, you know, I could just, you know, because I feel like that one time that I didn't have I didn't tell my daughter until the last minute, I felt a little more somber and I didn't feel like celebrating. I just felt like remembering and being with it. So,
yeah.
But I think it's very important to honor where you're at, and there are no two people grieve the same. And, you know, the things that I did the first year, I couldn't necessarily do the second year. You know, it changes all the time. Every anniversary is different. I try not to anticipate what it's going to look like.
Right.
Because
you
just don't know.
No, I mean, there could be so many things that just pop up that would be something that you and Eric would have done or would have heard or, you know, something like that, that would bring special meaning. So now, and you're right, everybody does grieve differently. So, you know, it's one of those things where it's just important to honor, you know, the individual's process, whatever it may be. One of the things that I wanted to kind of bring out was the idea of, you know, finding healthy outlets for grief. Can you talk a little bit about some ideas, either that some outlets that you used or maybe suggestions for those who are going through the process?
If you write, for sure, I highly recommend journaling, getting it out. If you're a painter, paint, because all of these feelings live in our body and they're just waiting for a way to come out. It's almost, I like to call it, it's almost like going to a gym, right? To get it out, to sweat it out. And so, writing, painting, singing, hiking. I feel like after my husband died, I just started spending more time in nature. I don't know. I mean, I would go to the park and I would lay under a tree and almost get lost in just staring at the tree. And I just found that to be such a profound experience, especially when you've lived through trauma like that and just sitting on grass or going to the beach. So all of those things were things that I feel helped me. I have to say I was in a support group for a whole year. And I will admit, most of the people in my group were probably 30 or 40 years older than me. Maybe not 40, 30 years older than me. And I just did the calculation in my head. I thought, no, it can't be that. But they were older and they had kids my age.
Right.
But it was, it was one of the best things I did. And I did that like a month after Eric died. And it was great because most of the time, you have the celebration of life for the funeral or whatever. And then, people come together and then people go on with their lives. But you're still left feeling the loss and going through these moments that pop up. But when you have a group and everyone is going through the same thing. And what was great about this group is that some of the people in it had been part of the group for longer. So they asked for like a 2-year commitment. So I had been, when I started, there was one woman that had been there for like a year. And I remember looking at her and thinking, oh my gosh, she's not crying when she talks about her husband. It's like, every time I would talk, I would just be a ball of tears and I could barely get the words out. So I feel like that was so helpful for me to see the process of and how grief is not linear. And somebody, maybe that same woman that had gone through it for a year, maybe the next week she's having a hard time. So that was something that I thought was important. And just being amongst friends, like not isolating yourself. I try, like if I'm having a hard time, I try to pick up the phone and call somebody or say, hey, can you talk? Do you have time? Because isolating yourself can sometimes be the worst thing because I feel like you can sink into, it's almost sometimes when you're in it, you can feel like you're in quicksand and you're wondering, am I ever going to come out of this? Mm-hmm. And sometimes a conversation with a friend is all you need to pull you out and to remind you of things and to just also just to hold space so that you can talk and let it out and feel better. Sometimes just talking, it makes such a huge difference.
Exactly. Now, one of the things that I noticed regarding the book is that there was a surprising question that can begin the healing process, and that would be to ask, would my loved one want me to stop living?
Yes.
That seems like it would be a real motivator to try and shift things up.
Yes, I think so. I feel, there have been times where I didn't want to do something or I didn't want to get out there or go out to dinner or whatever. And then I would remember, what would Eric want me to do? Would he want me to stay at home alone and wallow, or would he want me to get out? And I know that the worst thing that I could do he's not here anymore. I'm the one that's here, right? That's living this life. I get to watch our daughter grow up, go to school, graduate, all of these things. So I want to be there for her too.
Right.
And I feel like by me showing up in this life fully, I'm also honoring my husband because that's what he would have wanted.
Yeah, absolutely. And I loved the image that you had of him being in the backseat of the car with you driving, because I mean, it's very much like that. They're there with you, and they're going to be experiencing everything that you experience because you're driving the car.
Yes.
And nature is one of my favorite pastimes. We have a large gardens, and I'm in Myrtle Beach, and we have large gardens in the area. And every week I go, and I'm a photographer, so I take pictures. There will be times when I wouldn't feel like it, I would just say, well, you always feel better when you're done, it may be a little bit cooler than you want it to be, but just do it. Mm-hmm. And that was one of those, what would my loved one want me to do? And quite often during those walks, I would send pictures back so they could experience what I was experiencing. So it was one of those things that, you know, they knew very much that the gardens was very important to me. So.
I just thought of something that recently there was I had met this jazz musician at a show I went to with my friend, one of my girlfriends who just loves, you know, she's the kind of person you go to a place and she's met everybody because she talks to everybody. So I saw that this musician had a show and I was trying to get her to go with me, and she was busy and I kept asking people, hey, can you go? Can you come with me? No one was available. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to go alone. I'm going to go to the show. It's at this place I've never been to. It's like a dance studio, but I'm going to go. And I'm so glad I went. It wasn't like a typical scenario. It's this place called Motivo LA in Los Angeles, and they have, like I said, dance classes, but they had like a quartet of this new jazz, very, very well-regarded jazz musicians. And it was such an incredible experience. And it didn't matter that I wasn't, you know, I talked to a couple next to me at one point, and then they changed seats to another section so they could see a little bit better. But I was totally okay with being in that space alone. I didn't feel self-conscious. I just thought, I'm here to listen to good music. And it was just, I was so proud of myself because when I left, I just felt completely uplifted by the music and just the experience of being there. And I was so proud of myself for just saying, no, go. Yeah. I mean, what do you have to lose? Nothing.
Really? No. That's great. Well, that's wonderful. And, you know, and that's a true sign of moving forward.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Because I could have said, no, it's okay. I'll stay home. Yeah. I'll put something on Netflix. But I was in community and I was experiencing just like the musicians were, you know, they were totally into it. So you feel like you're a part of something very special when you get to witness that.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to kind of want to close with one topic, and that was you indicate that it's important to remain open to signs of hope after a loss. So can you tell us what you mean by that, and have you had any of these particular signs with Eric?
Yes, I have, and it has been very I've never been somebody that has, you know, sought out these things, and I've lost many people in my life, but after I lost Eric and we were so close that I started to experience you know, like one night I have many lamp sources in my bedroom, and the overhead lamp and a few other small lamps. And I heard my tall IKEA lamp turn on. I heard somebody turning, like switching the, like that clicking sound.
Uh-huh.
And I got up and I thought, okay. And I went into the living room, and I, you know, it was 12 a.m. I'm thinking, okay, why did he just turn on the lights? And I knew it was him because I had had other experiences like that. And I came in and, you know, nobody's in my house and my daughter's asleep. But I kept trying to figure out what is he saying? Why did he do that? And then I was talking to my grief counselor, and she said, you know, it sounds like, you know how you're driving and you're in this dark tunnel and you can't see anything. And then you come out of the tunnel and all of a sudden you can see. And she said, maybe he's trying to show you that there's light at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. And I got goosebumps all over because I had, at that stage when that happened, I was having things were kind of shifting in my life, and there were some exciting things happening too. And I felt I had finished writing the book, and mm-hmm. And I just felt when she said that, like, it clicked that that's what in my, and Eric was a writer. So a lot of the things that happen are very literal. Like,
okay.
So when that happened, I thought, okay, all right, I feel like that's what he meant. Like, why else would you turn on the tallest lamp in my bedroom, knowing that I kept saying, you know, I have to drive in the morning. I have to take the kids to school, like for carpool. And so I just felt that's what she meant. And so that's one little example. But there have been many, many things that have been very comforting for me and my daughter as well.
Yeah. And you know, I think being open to, you know, looking at these messages or the signs is real important, because you said, you know, you were comforted with them. And I truly believe that when those things happen, the ultimate goal of the one responsible is to comfort the person.
And also to say, hey, I'm watching out for you. I'm your cheerleader over here, and you know,
Well, that's great. Well, Rosemary, this has really been a wonderful chat. I really want to thank you for sharing with us and talking about your new book.
Thank you, and thank you for asking such great questions as well. You got me thinking. I appreciate it.
That's good. That's good. Because you did with me reading about all of this stuff too. So it was mutual. So again, thank you. And I am following you now on Instagram. So I look forward to seeing how things work.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, again, everyone, today my special guest has been Rosemary Baswani, author of When I Press Stop, A Memoir of Loss. Again, you can find out more about Rosemary by visiting her website, which is rosemarybaswani.com. That's Rosemary, VASWANI.com. And also, if you would like to find out more about CJD, which is what Eric had, you can visit the cjdfoundation.org. And everyone, I want to thank you. Oh, before I leave, I just want to say, by the way, Rosemary, I wish you wonderful success on the launch of your book on October 23rd.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And again, everyone, if you go to her website, you can pre-order the book now. So, again, everyone, in closing, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.